tonight, for the next few minutes or so, we're going to be questioning, maybe you've heard this question on the invite, there was an invite sent out, why am I never truly satisfied? I'm not sure if you've ever asked that question. Maybe you've quite enjoyed your life and you feel quite satisfied, but it's the question on many people's lips. So when we're talking about satisfaction, just imagine that feeling after eating a medium rare steak, triple cooked chips, peppercorn sauce, or a vegan version, if that's your preference, and you sit back in your chair and you say, ah, satisfied. You know what I'm talking about, your favorite meal. But think deeper than your stomach, think deeper than your emotions. I'm talking about a deeper hole that all of us have, and we just can't reach. We're trying to fill it with stuff, but nothing quite fits. I hope you know what I'm talking about. I'm going to give you a comedy example of this. So I don't know if people know Only Fools and Horses, maybe some older people in this place. It was a series. One of the main characters, Del Boy, his whole life was to be a millionaire. That was what he was living for. Then he finally gets it. He becomes the millionaire. The dream has come. And what does he do? It wasn't what he thought it was. So he goes back to wheeling and dealing on the streets of Peckham. That captures something of our lives. We chase something. We think we've got it. It didn't quite land. I'm still searching. Is that you? We hear it all over the place. So there's celebs that are going through this. They get everything they thought they dreamed of. Jim Carrey, I'm going to quote Jim Carrey on this. He's got such a good quote on this. He says, I hope that everyone gets everything they ever dreamed of so they can find out it's not the answer. He's basically saying there, I reached the pinnacle of everything I thought would make me happy and I'm still not happy. I'm still not satisfied. And it's confusing, this whole issue, because by now, we today in 2024 in London, we should be the happiest people who's ever lived. You've got more things at your fingertips than you've ever had in history. You don't have to send letters anymore. You've got communication at the touch of a button. You can order stuff from your house. You can grab anything from the comfort of your own home. You've got entertainment coming in from all directions. And yet we're worse off. I've got some stats, and these stats are focused on students, because students should be at the prime of their life. Students, this is quite a worrying statistic. Students on Mental Health Watch, that's a very serious thing if someone's on Mental Health Watch. It was 4% of students in 1997, now 25%. It's gone up. Suicide rates among 15 to 19-year-olds are the highest in 30 years. So it begs the question, something doesn't add up. We've got more stuff, more opportunities, and we're worse. What's going on? Well, tonight, the answer is found in John's Gospel, which we read earlier. John chapter 4, if you've got the Gospels in front of you, just listen along if you prefer that. But we're going to be looking at John chapter 4, where we meet this episode that's become known as the woman at the well. That's this episode, the woman at the well. So the first obvious question is, who is this woman at the well? Verse 7, I'll read it. It says, a woman from Samaria came to draw water. Now, you don't know much about her from that statement there. You don't know her name, but you do know this. She's going to a well to get water. So just imagine a well, it's deep. You have to draw water out of it. You have to travel to it. That's what's going on. Now, picture her. The heat of the Middle Eastern sun. Middle of the day, the hottest part of the day, she's by herself, lonely, coming again and again to this well to get water. Picture it, because it's a metaphor for something. It's symbolic of something deeper that's going on in her life. I'm going to give you a clue by reading something later that we find out about her. I'll read it, verse 16, and see if you can link the well and what she's doing with this. Verse 16, Jesus said to her, that woman, go call your husband and come here. The woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, "You are right in saying I have no husband, for you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband." So can you make the link? Go into a well every day, five husbands. The point is this. Just as she's thirsty for water, her soul is thirsting for something. That's the point. And it's pictured as a thirst. I don't know if you've really been thirsty in life. We've got taps everywhere. But imagine you've ran a 10K around London. Maybe that's easier for some of you to imagine than others. In the middle of the summer, you're desperate for a drink. That's what her soul is like. Can you resonate with that? And there's a well that she's been going to try and find this soul water, this water for my soul, satisfaction, happiness. And she's relying on a well that's going to provide it for her. Something's going to give me this. What do you think it is from what I read earlier? Five husbands, a sixth man who's not a husband. Where is she looking for this happiness? Love, relationships, marriage, men. It's a popular one still today. We're still doing the same things today, right? Love is still top of our agenda. But there's many wells that we go to. So this relates to all of us here. I can guarantee, including me, there's a well that all of us are going to make ourselves happy. I don't know what it is for you. It could be family, friends, sex, career, money, drink, drugs, social media, religion. There's so many wells that we have at our disposal. Maybe for you it's one that you keep going back to again and again and again, like this woman. Or maybe it's a selection. You've got this one, you try this one, you try this, you try this. You don't want one. You're going to go to a few. Now, I'm speaking to someone who has done the very same thing. So the point here is that's what's going on. When you see her go into a well, picture the deeper picture going on in her life. But note this, she has to keep coming back. How many husbands? Five. And the sixth man she's with is not even her husband now. So that would be shocking today, I think, would it? Five husbands? I still think that would be quite shocking today. Imagine then. This is an abnormal scenario. And just try and picture it. She gets married, her dream has come true. Find the man of my dreams. Then something happens. I don't know what happened. Did someone cheat on someone? Was there no dinner on the table? I don't know what it was, but it led to a divorce. So second man, dream alive again. Something happens again. Third, imagine how she's feeling each time. Third man, maybe now. No. Fourth man, fifth man. Are you getting a sense of it? Sixth man. She's had enough, surely. She's weary. She's tired. She's broken. Brokenhearted. That's the situation of this woman. But note this. She's worse off than she began the search. She's broken now. She's guilty now. In fact, I can say this. She's lost hope. How do I know that? Because five husbands, sixth man is not her husband. She gave up on marriage. She gave up on the dream of being happily married. She's settled for something less now. She's hopeless. She's lost hope. Is that you? The point tonight is, who's this woman at the well? It's me. It's you. It's people around us in our society. She's us. We're her. I mean, if you want to know something of the brokenness of this, think about a porn addict. They made that first click. They found joy. Oh, this is it. Wow. And they end up broken, 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 watching stuff they never thought they'd watch, and now they're empty. Make any parallel. Drink. The person that starts with the first drink, what happens? Anything. This is us. This woman represents us. But here in this chapter, her life is about to change forever. That's the good news here. Things really do change for her. Because that day that she went to this well, there's someone sitting at the well waiting for her. She never expected this. Who is it? Jesus. You might say, so what? An old religious leader that lived 2,000 years ago. But John has told us, if you've got John's gospel in your hand, the first chapter of John opens with the simple truth, but profound truth, that this man, Jesus Christ, is none other than God himself, the one who made the universe. he is sitting by the well waiting for her. Do you feel the suspense? This woman meets God. And it's not a fairy tale. John has said this happened. And the point is this. It can happen for you. You've just heard a testimony from Dan. It's happening today. Jesus is in heaven, but he's changing lives today by his Holy Spirit that is here even tonight. The point is you can discover this. So the next question is how? How did this woman meet Jesus? Was she seeking? Was she praying? Was she trying to be good? Was she religious? No. She's just going about her daily business. She's going to the well. She went there regularly. She's actually in the middle of her pursuits. She's with man number six. She hasn't had an epiphany. She hasn't had a religious epiphany. She's still doing the same thing she was always doing. And she bumps into Jesus. Is it a coincidence? No. Verse 4 tells us, if you go back a few verses, Jesus had to pass through Samaria. He had to. Jesus is seeking her. She wasn't seeking him. He was seeking her. He had to pass through. He had an appointment to meet her that she didn't even know was there. And he even opens the conversation. Verse 7, what does he say to her? Give me a drink. He breaks the ice. Now, there's ice here. I'm going to try and explain that very quickly. She is shocked that this man asks her for a drink. Do you see that in verse 9? She says, how is it that you, a Jew, ask for a drink from me, a woman of Samaria? What? John tells us why that's such a shock. He goes on to say, for Jews have no dealings with Samaritans. So I want you to imagine she's here, Jesus is here, and there's all these barriers in the way. She's a woman, he's a man. In that day, men would not speak to women, especially rabbis like Jesus, teachers. She's a Samaritan, he's a Jew. Now you might think, so what? Well, they're enemies. What's it like? Is it like Spurs-Arsenal kind of enemy? I've got an Arsenal friend sitting here. It's worse. It's worse than anything. The only example I could think of today that's prominent is Israel-Palestine. If they cross paths, it would be something of this. They're enemies. They would have no dealings, John says. But there's more. She's a sinner who's messed up her life. He is the perfect, holy Son of God. But he's the one who breaks the ice. He's the one who starts the conversation. So the point here, this so far, is this is so different to what we're used to. We're used to religion that says you have to seek God. And God's waiting over here with his arms folded, with his back turned, and you've got to win him round. You've got to do some prayers or fasting. I don't know what it is. But in Christianity, it's the other way around. We've got our backs turned, messing around with this, and he's coming for us, and he's waiting for us. That's the good news in Christianity. It's the opposite to what you expect. So the point here tonight is you might not be seeking Jesus tonight. You might just happen to be here. You might have heard there's food afterwards and said, right, I'll come to that. But Jesus is seeking you. And he had to pass through APC tonight. He has a word for you tonight. Next question then. What happened when she met Jesus? Because maybe it still doesn't grab your attention. So I've broken it down into three things. What happened when this woman met Jesus? What changed? Well, firstly, she finally discovers what she's been looking for. Verse 10. Jesus answered her, if you knew the gift of God and who it is that is saying to you, give me a drink, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. I must emphasize this here because picture the scene so far. All she's heard from Jesus is him saying to her, give me a drink. That's all she's heard. Imagine what's going on in her head. Typical, typical. Another man that wants something from me. Take, take, take. It's all people do. It's all he wants. And that's us too. I've got a funny story. There's a person in our youth group, I won't mention names, who said to a youth group leader, you're my favourite leader. And do you know what the leader said back? What do you want? That's what we do. Whenever someone's really nice to us, we're suspicious. What do you want? What do you want? And we do the same with God. We assume that God is going to be the same as what I've experienced around me. It's the call of religion. Give, do. God is taking something from you. He's here to ruin your life, ruin your fun. But Jesus has come to give. The opposite. What's he come to give us? Well, firstly, it's a gift. Did you notice that in verse 10? If you knew the gift of God. A gift is free. It's not paid for. You don't have to pay something. It's a gift. Grace, have you heard the song Amazing Grace? Grace means undeserved, an undeserved gift. You didn't deserve it. You did the very things that meant you shouldn't have got the gift, but he's given it anyway. That's grace. Took me a while to get this, by the way. I still don't get it. I still live my Christian life thinking I have to owe God something. It's hardwired into us. I have to earn. Picture two people fighting for a bill. Do you see that? It seems to be British culture that does this. They fight for the bill. No, I'm paying. But we do that with God. No, I'm paying. And he says, no, I've paid, as we're going to see later. We do it with God, but he's given us a gift. What is the gift? Here's where it gets good, so please listen up. I hope this bit resonates. I hope it makes sense. What is this gift he's given? Well, look there. Jesus says, water. You would have, verse 10, you would have asked him and he would have given you living water. Now think about water. I've just said that this woman's search for water represents her search for happiness and satisfaction. So make the link. Jesus is offering you water that will satisfy your soul. That's the first thing. But there's more. It's living water. What does that mean? Well, picture a stale, static well where the water's just stale. It's been there for a while. And then picture a spring that's flowing. It's bubbling. It's life. It's fresh. Jesus is saying, what I offer you is that compared to this. So think of everything you've lived for in this world, that list I said earlier, all the gifts, all the good things, family, friend, they're all here in a well that's stale compared to this living water that Jesus is offering you. What I'm basically saying here is, what's the happiest you've been in life? Maybe that's the marker there. What Jesus offers you is way up here. That's basically the point of living water. It's something you've never tasted before. That's not like what you found in this world. Living water, eternal water. Did you notice that? He said you'll never thirst again. Verse 14. You'll never be thirsty again. We've never heard of that before. He's saying that you, if you take one drink of what I give you, you'll live forever beyond death. Never thirsty again. This is eternal life we're talking about here. So let's try and explain what I've said so far. Imagine a scale, and this side is how long it lasts for, and this one, this axis, is how good it is. When we think of what Christianity offers, and we hear eternal life, we just look at this one, and we think, right, Jesus is saying that I'm going to live forever, so it means this life times infinity. And we don't like the idea of that, because this life is often rubbish. Maybe it's just me. But no, it's off the scale that way. It goes on forever. But it's also off the scale this way. It's higher and better than anything you've ever tasted. Take it from me. I was someone who lived for this. I was sleeping, doing everything that you could imagine a teenage boy would do. And then I tasted one drop of what Jesus gives. And I've never looked back. Forget that. That's what we're talking about here. But did you notice one more thing? He says, welling up. That means it only gets better. So the way this world works is it lures you in and it says, right, come and have a bit of this. And you take it, and it's quite nice at the beginning, and then it crashes, and you end up in the gutter. Think of a person that goes on a night out, clubbing, they get drunk, have the best time of their life, then the next morning, how are they feeling? That's what this world does. It's great, and then it goes boom. With Jesus, it's the opposite. He gives you one drop and it's already better than that. And then it only gets better and better into forever. So I can say this, that the best that a Christian has tasted in this life is still just a drop compared to what they're going to taste in heaven. It is amazing. So if you're sitting there tonight and you think Christianity's boring, please stop looking at Christians. We can sometimes be a rubbish advert for this, sadly. We shouldn't be. Listen to Jesus' words here. That is what he's offering you. But there's one more thing to say about this water. This water is God himself. When we go through John's gospel, you start to hear things like, the water is God's spirit. And then you get a bit later on in John's gospel, and you hear Jesus talking about God coming to live inside you. And you add it all up and you think, ah, this water is God coming to live inside my soul. Wow. Now it starts to make sense why the water's so good. Jesus is offering this woman to be filled with God himself. That's why she'll be satisfied. This is what she's been looking around for, but she's been looking in the wrong place. So no wonder after all this, the woman says, I love this. She says, verse 15, sir, give me this water so that I will not be thirsty or have to come here to draw water. She doesn't quite get what he's talking about, but it sounds good. Whatever he's saying, give me. Is that you? Is your ears pricked up? He's offering you this. But there's something else that happens when she meets Jesus. The second thing is she finally sees her problem. This is important. Verse 16, let's read it again. Jesus says, wait a minute. You've asked for it? Well, he says, verse 16, go call your husband and come here. The woman answered him, I have no husband. Jesus said to her, you're right in saying I have no husband. For you have had five husbands, and the one you have now is not your husband. What you have said is true. Jesus is basically saying to her, I know everything about you. I know about your life. I know you. That sounds nice maybe on one level, but just imagine your life was projected for all to see. Everything, your thoughts, everything you ever said, your secrets, it's all on projected. How would you feel? Maybe some parts you'd be very proud of, but other parts you'd want to hide, you'd want to cover. Well, the very thing this woman would want covered, Jesus lifts up and plasters it in her face. Did you see that? Did you notice when she says, I have no husband? She suddenly goes abrupt. She's not enjoying this bit. She's gone quiet. Jesus has brought up her pain. He's brought up her guilt, because this is talking about things she's done wrong. Remember, God had commands. He has commands today. They're the same. They haven't changed. Adultery. He's talking about marriage. She is with a man now who's not even her husband. Jesus is bringing up sin. Now, here's where it gets uncomfortable. That word sin, you're thinking, right, here we go. I was waiting for that mention of sin. But it's so important. Jesus lifts it up and wants her to look. Did you notice that? And it's her particular sins. I think it's quite easy for us to, I hear this a lot. Yeah, we're all sinners, aren't we? No one's perfect. That doesn't really land anywhere with anyone. It's like, yeah, we're all. No, particular issues, things you've done. He zooms in on something she's actually done. Have you found that? Maybe you've sat in churches before and you felt God do this. And he's pointing his finger at something you've done. And whoa, uncomfortable. Why does Jesus do that? Why do Christians keep going on about sin? Do we get a kick out of it? It's because, I hope this clicks right now. It changed things for me. Sin links to my thirst. Why am I thirsty? Why am I unsatisfied? It links to this problem of sin. The two are connected. Let me try and explain it. In this chapter, we have a perfect illustration of it. This woman, right, God is over here, living water we've learned tonight. He will satisfy you. He will give you life forever. What this woman has done is she said, no, thank you. I'm going to go over here and drink of this. That's sin. I've rejected God and I'm now drinking something else. I've chosen something else, right? And I've chosen the things that he's made instead of him. That's what we've all done. We've rejected God and we've said, no, I'm going to live for this now. That's what she's done. And do you see how that links to not being satisfied? Of course I'm not going to be satisfied. I've, I've rejected the fountain of living water and I've settled for stale water. I'm going to die over here because the source of life is over here. That's why we die. That's why there's hell, because we've made our choice. Do you see how that makes, I hope that makes sense. Sin is serious. We've actually rejected God personally and chosen something that he's made to replace him. Does that now start to make sense why there's death and hell that follows? I hope. There is a consequence to that choice. And she's starting to see it now. Listen to her response. Verse 19. The woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive you are a prophet. Our fathers worshipped on this mountain, but you say that in Jerusalem is the place where people ought to worship." That's her response. And you might be thinking, what's she doing here? Is she changing subject? Maybe. Because it's easier to have a religious debate than talk about my own sin. I think that's why some people love religious debates, because it's much easier to talk about debates out there than actually things that I've done wrong against God. Maybe it's that. But what if it could be her saying, "You're right, Jesus. I have done that. And you must be a prophet because you know that about me. How do I get to God then? How do I reach God being the person that I am?" What if she's saying that? I think that could be possible. Either way, she's finally seen the problem. Jesus has lifted it up in her face. Have you seen it? Have you seen that the reason you're not satisfied is because you've chosen to live without God your way instead of with him, his way? But there's one more thing she sees. There's one more thing that happens when she meets Jesus. This is key. We can't stop here. It's not just enough to see the problem. She finally sees the answer. Listen to what Jesus says, verse 21. This is in answer to her question. "Woman, believe me, the hour is coming when neither on this mountain nor in Jerusalem will you worship the Father. You worship what you do not know. We worship what we know, for salvation is from the Jews. But the hour is coming and is now here when true worshippers will worship the Father in spirit and truth. For the Father is seeking such people to worship him." Now, we don't have time to go into depth into what he's saying there. But one thing I can say is he's answered her and he said, yes, you're right. There is a right way to approach God. There's a temple at that time. There's sacrifices because we're sinners. We have to approach him in a certain way. But, he says, there is a time coming where there's going to be no more temples, no more rituals, no more sacrifices. Someone like you can know God where you are right now. You don't have to be in a church even. You can know God in spirit and truth. That's what he's basically said to her. And listen to what she says, verse 25. The woman said to him, "I know that Messiah is coming. He who is called Christ. When he comes, he will tell us all things." Hope has come up in her out of nowhere. The Christ is the person promised throughout the whole Bible. And out of nowhere, she comes out with this amazing statement. It's like Jesus has awakened this hope in her that was buried under her mess of a life. And he's reignited it. There's a Christ coming who's going to fix this mess that I'm in. And Jesus says, "I who speak to you am he." Think about how that would have landed for her. The Christ is the figure in the whole Bible, and he's standing right in front of her, talking to her all this time, and she didn't even know it. Imagine how that would have landed when he said that. In that one word, Christ, Jesus has answered all of her problems in one word, because the Christ is the one to save us. The Christ is the one to fix our mess. The Christ is the one to bring us back to God. And how did he do it? If you follow John's gospel through, if you take it home and read it, you're going to find that this Christ, the innocent one, is going to go to a cross and he's going to die. Why? Why did Jesus die on the cross? I always had this question. It never made sense to me. Well, hopefully it links to this chapter if I say this. On the cross, he cried out two words. "I thirst." Do you see how that links with what we've just been looking at? He's just promised this woman never to thirst again, living water, and then he himself says, "I thirst." Can you work out what's going on? He's traded places with her. He's stood where she is. He's taken her place. He's taken her sins, her death, her shame, hell, so she can come over here and drink freely of the living water that he gives. He swapped places. That's what he did. He was willing to do it. He laid down his life for this. He paid the price so she and us can freely drink.